Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, broadcasting around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. On the show today, the Environmental Protection Agency gives Utah 3 years to address unacceptable ozone pollution levels. Why Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes signed a pro-fracking letter over the objections of state regulators. The plans for a new center to honor the legacy of Senator Orrin Hatch and the story of a Utah police officer who for years suffered personal trauma and survivor guilt, and the work he's doing now to get other officers to find the help they need. Joining me this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And we've got Paul Raleigh, columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, here in studio with us as well. Thanks for being here, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning. And on the phone from Washington, for a little while at least, is Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Hello and welcome, Tommy.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Good morning. And you are invited to weigh in on the stories that we are covering today. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us at 801-355-8255. Tommy, we have you for just a little bit, and so we're going to kick things off with you. You reported this week on a couple of items related to Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. Point one is the now official launch of the Hatch Center, a facility to honor the legacy of the senator, who is retiring at the rapidly approaching end of his final term. Honor the legacy. Tommy, is this a museum, or what will the Hatch Center be and do?
You know, it's going to be one of those all-of-the-above kind of situations. Excuse me. So, you know, Orrin Hatch ran for president in 1999, and that didn't work out, so he doesn't have a presidential library. But what he's planning and what his supporters are planning is essentially about the same thing. It's going to be on South Temple. It's going to be partnered with the University of Utah, and the Hatch Center will be, when it's finally built, essentially an archive of all of his 42 years of records, his, you know, legislative accomplishments, his, you know, letters, all the knickknacks that he's been given, and the awards he's been given. It's going to also be like, you know, a place for a forum for future leaders. The idea is some kind of, you know, policy institute of some sort mixed with, you know, forums and discussions about how to solve the, you know, the country's problems, the world's problems, in that vein of what Hatch, you know, wanted to do while he was in office. This, in many ways, is kind of a similar and kind of a copy of what Ted Kennedy did in Boston before he passed. They built a center for him that does essentially the same thing.
This is tied to the Hatch Foundation, and you reported, Tommy, that there have been some questions about how the foundation is funded, mainly because a lot of the donation sort of records are private there, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that becomes an issue with some people who have raised, you know, concerns about Hatch is still the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. It's a very powerful committee that oversees, you know, everything from, you know, the healthcare industry to, you know, banking and other things. And right now, this nonprofit is raising money. They won't say how much they've raised, but I've heard anywhere from, you know, $100 to $150 million is a goal. I'm not sure what the current goal is right now because, they won't say. But right now, they've already raised about $6 million, and we only know a fraction of that because of, you know, Senate disclosures. So we really may not, at the end of the day, know who's funding this big center to honor Hatch.
Paul Raleigh, I want to bring your voice on this, the editorial voice, in on this for a second, because the Hatch Center, let's just leave that up for, you know, to the side for a second and answer another question for me, if you would. It seems that we have seen a proliferation of business schools and policy institutes, think tanks, on our higher ed campuses or connected to our universities. And I don't necessarily, I'm not trying to frame that in a negative light, but I want to ask the question, do we need another political think tank at the University of Utah, if that is indeed what the Hatch Center, at least in part, will be?
Well, I don't know a lot about this Hatch Center, but, you know, it seems to me it could potentially be a great resource, you know, for all the records, and it could be a great educational tool for people who are interested in that sort of thing. As far as these think tanks and business schools, you know, the best example of that has brought a lot of concern, I think, is the Koch brothers have funded a lot of these, you know, special, you know, areas in business schools, special, you know, foundations or endowed chairs or whatever. And there has been a lot of criticism that they fund those with there are things conditions attached in how the you know the type of things that are taught there.
Sure.
and basically they're there to push a right-wing agenda endorsed by the Koch brothers. And so there are some concerns about that, but I do think that if it's done right, the Hatch Center could be a pretty good resource for this community.
Dan Harry, government editor, this speaks to the powerful role that Hatch carved for himself both in D.C. and a very long career that he had. It does feel a little bit like a presidential library, which is, as Tommy described.
Well, there's a couple of interesting things I think about it. One is that they're going to have a facsimile of his office there, which is, I don't know, that sounds kind of strange to me. But he also...
It's going to be oval in some sort.
But he also will have an office there, I guess, that he can write books and write essays or whatever he'll write. I wonder also if he'll write some music there. So there may be a piano in the office that he actually uses. But the one question I had was, it's right across the street from the Thomas S. Monson Center.
The Kim C. Gardner Policy Institute, which is right there on South Temple.
Well,
yes.
Well, where they announced it is called the Thomas S. Monson Center.
Yeah.
And I wondered which building will be bigger, the Orange E. Hatch building or the Thomas S. Monson building?
Tommy, any answer to that question yet?
No, I'm still just wondering, though. I can't wait to see the papers that he's written about me, personal notes. That'll be fun.
There's one, just to leave this behind in a second, but presidents come and go. Some senators spend a lifetime in their seats, so there's arguably more to document if you're a senator who's been there for decades than you would have to do if you were president.
You know, in some ways, this is a little-known fact, but Senator Hatch employs an archivist, and there's a person on his staff whose job is to kind of go through these things. 42 years is a long time, and you've got to, kind of collate those and have them organized in some form. So he has a lot of papers, and I remember one time joking because he'd won some award and he had it in his hand, and I'm like, "Where does it go?" And he's like, "Oh, I have a shed to put it in because he's got so many awards over time." So I'm sure they'll be nicely on display there.
Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that Senator Hatch is the longest-serving Republican senator. I know Strom Thurmond served longer, but he was a Democrat for a long time. But I believe that Hatch is the longest-serving Republican senator in history. Is that correct?
You are correct, sir.
Senator Hatch is also going to be honored with, speaking of awards, here in Salt Lake City by the Salt Lake Chamber. Tommy, they're anointing him with a giant in the city award. And the keynote address for this accolade will be delivered by a well-known, albeit not Utah-connected name. Tell us about this, Tommy.
House Speaker Paul Ryan is coming to Salt Lake on June 9. He's going to speak at the Grand America Hotel. So this is the Salt Lake Chamber does the Giant in the City Award every year, and it's essentially they consider it the most prestigious business award in Utah. Somebody devoted to helping the state and the economy and doing well. And so they're honoring Orrin Hatch this time, and I think Dan could correct me here, but this is only the second time they've honored somebody who's currently serving in office. Is that right, Dan?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So Paul Ryan, obviously is this House Speaker, so he's, second in line for the presidency behind the Vice President, and Orrin Hatch is third in line. So at one moment you'll have the, second in line and the third in line for the presidency in one room.
If somebody offers a prayer there, they better be careful about what they say, I would assume, with Ryan there.
Paul Raleigh, this is like just to wrap this up. This is there's an Orrin Hatch love fest going on here in Utah. There was a moment though, and Dan, you can comment on this as well, where it looked like it was even probable or possible that Hatch was going to run for an eighth term. But now he's the prodigal son or the prodigal grandfather.
It was much longer than a moment. It went on for months, the speculation of whether he was going to run or not. And, I don't know whether he had decided early on that he wouldn't run again and just let the speculation kind of fuel itself and go on, or whether he really had a hard time deciding whether to leave. I don't know which of those it was.
Right. Sources that I of mine that are close to Hatch have told me, these months ago as this was unfolding, that he had decided not to run. pretty early on, but then he started having second thoughts. And then, you know, I guess it's hard to let that kind of power go. But so that's what took him so long for a long time. And then I think he wanted to wait until he made the announcement so he wouldn't be so much, such a lame duck after he made that announcement, at least as, for as long as, for a very long time.
Since we're on the palace intrigue part here, I'll just jump into that the White House played a role in this, too, because President Trump wanted Orrin Hatch to run again, and he's one of, you know, the president's favorite senators. So he really wanted to keep, you know, this staunch ally in the Senate. Of course, the president also then phoned Mitt Romney when he decided to run and encouraged him to run. So we'll see how that turns out.
There also was a lot of talk that this the center, Orrin G. Hatch Center, that they just announced the other day, was sort of part of the incentive to encourage him to retire, that Mitt Romney and Kim Gardner and others were saying, look, we'll raise all this money. This will be a first-class facility, and it will be a wonderful tribute, you know, to your legacy. So come on, do this.
Right. Yeah, step down, I guess. Well, the end of an era or an eon, maybe. Thomas, we'll be following the election to replace Senator Orrin Hatch over the coming months, but for a time there was also a sense that Hatch was, kind of passing the seat off to Mitt Romney. Has he officially endorsed Mitt Romney? Did I miss that altogether?
Yeah, essentially he said that he's backing Mitt Romney. And that was before that we really knew who was going to challenge Mitt Romney. So I haven't talked to the senator recently about that. But certainly, you know, Orrin Hatch has been backing Mitt Romney.
Sure.
Since we're talking about fun stuff right now, there's a Washington Examiner story where they quote Mitt Romney today, and he's asked, what's your favorite meat? And he says, hot dog. Hot dog, then burgers, then steak. So, you know, he's trying to be a true American right there.
Is hot dog really a meat is a question I have. Guys, we need to head to our first break, but Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief, I know you need to run. Thank you for joining us for the first segment of the show this morning.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to turn to the story behind the pro-fracking letter Attorney General Sean Reyes signed along with his then Oklahoma counterpart, Scott Pruitt. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Saturday and Weekend Edition, the latest on the Russia investigation and the revolving cast of White House lawyers, a look at guns in American youth, and Howard Bryant on contemporary black athletes who speak out and the consequences.
You can't have this conversation without talking about 9/11.
Hear why Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning from 6 to 9 with Kirsten Swanson on Utah Public Radio.
In 10 little minutes, when I say the word, all the evil people all over the world will become half their present size so they can be known.
Great power. This week on Selected Shorts from PRI Public Radio International.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Environment reporter Emma Penrod is with us. Good morning, Emma.
Morning.
And columnist Paul Raleigh. It is our Friday morning local news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or posting your comments at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, to a story now about Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes, and it's actually a story whose origin goes back a few years, something that is just getting some additional light shown on it now. It has to do with a letter that Reyes signed back in 2014 that put him kind of in opposition to the heads of some state agencies here in Utah. Maybe you can just lay this story out for us. What was this letter?
Yeah, so this letter came from Scott Pruitt when he was the Oklahoma Attorney General. Pruitt now is the EPA right. administrator and under fire from a number of fronts.
Right.
But Pruitt was one of the main opponents and critics of the EPA, has been for years. And at this time, he wanted to, send a letter criticizing the EPA inspector general for investigating the effects of fracking. there was a question, you know, whether the fracking is hazardous to the environment, whether it causes other problems. And so he wanted to write a letter, you know, saying EPA's inspector general should not be investigating this. They should be looking at waste and fraud within the agency. And so he wanted to shop it around through the Republican Attorneys General Association. RAGA is the acronym for that. And they are very active politically. The New York Times did a series about how much influence they had on public policy in a number of ways. And this was one of them where they shopped this letter around to a number of attorneys general. Sean Reyes was one of them. He had just taken office, by the way. This was in 2014 and after John Swallow had resigned after a year in office. And his department heads of environmental quality and the, I think it was the Department of Water.
Yes, Department of Water Quality, Division of Water
Division
Quality.
Division of Water Quality had both said, you know, why would we want to sign on to this? Science is good, you know. If the EPA Inspector General wants to look into these things, there's no reason we should oppose that. And Reyes, his chief lieutenant at the time, Bridget Romana, said, this is politics, pure and simple. Mm-hmm. And she was passing along the concerns of the department heads to Sean Reyes. He went ahead and signed the letter.
And the Republican Attorney General's Association, it turns out, is funded to a pretty big degree by the oil and gas industry, which would, of course, oppose any regulation, I guess, not any, but some regulation on fracking.
Right. And they are huge contributors. In fact, for Sean Reyes, they were his number one contributors in both 2014 and 2016. They contributed $300,000 to his campaigns.
Hmm. Reyes spokesman Rick Cantrell disputes the idea that energy groups are pulling strings in his office and that, you know, there's also the notion that he's signing these letters as sort of a private citizen and not as the attorney general, or that it's not an official act. Is there anything more than letter signing going on here, Dan?
Well, we don't know exactly. And one of the things that this was from a nonprofit group, you know, a conservation group, minded group, and they had to sue to get a bunch of correspondence and email from the Oklahoma archives that the Pruitt papers when he was attorney general. And now the same thing is going on with Sean Reyes, where they are suing him in state court for his emails and correspondence. And the AG's office claims these are all personal. Well, as you can see from these exchange of emails, a fraction of which we do have access to, is that he is using his personal email account for these policy discussions. And the AG's office is saying, oh, no, this is his personal policy. It's not the office policy. Well, you know, that doesn't ring very true. I mean, he's the attorney general. When he signs these letters, he's signing it as the attorney general of Utah. He's not doing it as, you know, a personal favor to a friend. Hmm.
Paul Raleigh, editorial voice on the show today, the, you know, RAGA, the Republican Attorney General's Association, gave, as Dan Harry said, a lot of money to Sean Reyes's campaign. He was going against the heads of some state agencies here, the Division of Water Quality and the Department of Environmental Quality. Political calculus. What do you make of this, Paul Raleigh?
Well, before I mention Reyes, I can't help but mention the irony of Scott Pruitt saying that they should focus on fraud and waste in the EPA. Here's a guy that was a $45,000 soundproof booth for himself, and anyway, beyond that, Sean Reyes's reluctance to be open about what he's been doing and why he's been doing it and sharing any emails is consistent with him his time in the AG's office from the time he took that office. He is probably the least transparent public official. I mean, these people are now having to sue him you know, for his emails. The Tribune had to sue him one time for his for not coming forward with an attorney general's opinion. He got in a fight with the legislature about it. As far as his contributions, that's another consistency with Sean Reyes. He's always been seemed to be very friendly about with people who contribute a lot of money to his campaign. And he's always been very political. He's jumped onto the Republican attorney generals on all their things from the time he came in, when they were trying to sue Barack Obama all the time. You might recall when he was being rumored as being on the short list for chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, all of a sudden he started getting all these contributions from these major corporations who had been scrutinized and oftentimes fined and punished by the Federal Trade Commission. Mm-hmm. And that might have been one of the reasons why once that our colleague Robert Gerke did a great column about that, that might be one of the reasons why he was pushed aside.
Dan Harry, I want to ask if there's, in your mind, I guess the question that I have is whether or not there is any political liability here for Sean Reyes. I mean, siding with the Republican Attorney General's Association isn't going to offend most Utah voters.
Well, it's not going to offend most Utah voters, except for the fact that he is supposed to be representing state agencies.
Right.
And when state agencies in their field of concern are raising these concerns and he goes against their wishes, it raises the question, who is he representing? Mm.
One of the areas where this group, the Republican Attorney General's Association, exerted its muscle was over a new ozone rule that came into effect in 2015 or that was being proposed in 2015. And I actually want to turn to a story now related to ozone pollution that actually also involves Scott Pruitt, or at least his EPA. Emma Penrod, Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter. Ozone pollution in Utah, we have too much of it. For a few years, we've been sort of skirting measurements that would violate EPA acceptable levels. This week, you reported that Utah in various counties is now in violation of EPA standards. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, we've technically been in violation of this standard for a while. Technically, as soon as that 2015 standard went into effect, they lowered it slightly based on some new science that was coming out that was showing that ozone was perhaps more harmful, or at least harmful in smaller quantities than was previously thought. Initially, there were some calls to lower it further than they did. The EPA compromised. And they dropped it from 75 parts per billion to 70 parts per billion. Mm-hmm. So just a small decrease. Utah, the measurement that the EPA was looking at to determine compliance was 76 parts per billion. So slightly above the old standard, but it was the, dropping the standard, creating the new standard that triggered the scrutiny.
And is this across Utah or is it in various parts? I mean, this is in different parts.
That measurement was in Bountiful.
Okay.
Right. So and it would be at whichever air monitor in question. So, that was what would determine it for the Bountiful area. And there'd be another monitor that would look elsewhere. But that was the number that, the state was throwing around as kind of here's an example of where we're at. That being the case, they put these new standards into effect. It creates this whole process legally where state regulators, they look at their monitoring values, they determine whether they're in compliance with the standard. And Utah figured out pretty quickly that it was not in many areas. There's seven counties that were not in compliance. So we've known that for a number of years. The EPA, in a letter to the governor, acknowledged that. Several months ago. But getting these official designations has been somewhat delayed and finally came out this week that officially this was what they were going to do. They were going to designate these seven counties as being in non-attainment, which then legally triggers another whole process.
I was going to say it puts certain things into motion. What are the things that it puts into motion? There's a three-year deadline of a sort. Tell us about that, Emma.
Yeah. So because the EPA classified all of Utah's non-attainment areas as marginal non-attainment areas, that That's the lowest level. That means that Utah doesn't really have anything that it's required to do except for over the 3 years keep track of the situation. They could voluntarily try to take measures to reduce the level of ozone. And in 3 years, they'll, you know, come back and look at it. And if we're still over the standard, then they, you know, would raise us into, you know, more severe forms of non-attainment, which come with more strict requirements from the EPA. With every, it usually is 3 years is about the, you know, interval. So with every roughly 3 year deadline that Utah misses, the rules that Utah has to abide by become stricter. You know, the EPA will dictate further what Utah has to do.
You said we could voluntarily do something to try and mitigate our ozone pollution. Is that on the table? Is that something that Utah environmental regulators are looking at doing? Is finding a way to decrease? Well, is actively finding a way to decrease ozone pollution?
Their stance on it is that the models they're running right now indicate that federal actions such as, you know, emissions requirements for vehicles are going to result in cleaner fuels, cleaner vehicles on the Wasatch Front, and that this should over time decrease the amount of ozone on the Wasatch Front. They are taking a more active role in the Uinta Basin area where they have a little bit more unique situation.
Well, it's an entirely different situation, it turns out, because, so here, let's explain this for people. I mean, who haven't heard us have this conversation in the past, but in the urban areas in Utah, ozone is caused by mainly emissions going into the atmosphere and then being broken apart, essentially. Is that a correct way of...
Right.
Yeah.
All ozone is ultimately... It's not directly emitted. It's what's called a secondary pollutant. It forms in the atmosphere as a result of chemicals interacting with other chemicals. Generally speaking, ozone is created when you get, you know, chemicals associated with combustion, especially in cars, in the atmosphere that then react with sunlight and create ozone. That's why ozone is associated with the summer as a pollutant.
And that's how it's happening here in the urban areas. But in Duchesne and Uinta counties, this unique situation you were describing, what's happening there?
They actually experience ozone spikes in the winter. And exactly how that is happening, scientists are still teasing out, but it has been strongly linked to emissions from oil and gas industries. I mean, they're not emitting the ozone again, but they are emitting the chemicals that appear to be creating this ozone in the winter.
You know, as a state, we struggle, or we've been struggling, with air pollution. Most frequently, we've been cited for having bad particulate pollution. Ozone is something different, but still pretty dangerous, dangerous for certain groups in particular. Can you talk about what ozone does to us, Emma?
Yeah, so we're more familiar, Utahns generally are more familiar with particulate pollution. That's what we get in the winter during the inversions. You see it, you smell it, nobody likes it. You know, and we've been in non-attainment for that for over a decade. So a similar situation, we don't meet the EPA standards, we keep missing these deadlines, it just keeps getting ratcheted up, but we remain over the standard. When you have those particulates, that's kind of like having like a rough abrasive sandpaper grating against your lungs. And so that's, you know, obviously going to create irritation, it causes harm, it's been associated with, you know, a number of respiratory conditions. Reports have come out showing that it's probably associated with causing lung cancer on the Wasatch Front. It also, when we inhale these particles, they're so small they enter our bloodstream, and they travel throughout the body where they cause more problems. Ozone is not a particle. It's a gas. And when you inhale it, it has a tendency to create almost like a sunburn effect on the inside of the lungs, which then when they heal creates scar tissue that has this permanent cumulative effect on our respiratory health.
You said that for the state, I mean, there's unique ways the state is maybe going. I guess here's a question I have is oil and gas drilling in Uinta and Duchesne counties is maybe the cause up there. Down here, as we said, it's cars. Here in the urban areas, the state's plan is essentially wait because new fuels are coming on board, new cars are coming on board, and that will apparently lessen our ozone pollution. In those areas where it's maybe linked to drilling, are we, for example, looking at decreasing the amount of oil and gas leases that are given out in these areas?
Well, what the Division of Air Quality has done is they have, you know, when you emit a certain number of emissions into the air, there's a threshold at which you you have to then get a permit from the state to emit those chemicals. And what they have done is they've said, you know what, even the really small oil and gas rigs that normally wouldn't, you know, qualify as needing a permit, need a permit in that area. And so they're creating a sort of registry and an inventory so that they can get a better handle on, you know, just how much of these emissions are going into the air out there.
I think I want to bring in the editorial voice, Paul Raleigh, on this. Paul, the plan from the state, at least here, is to wait and not take a sort of active role in addressing it. I don't know actually what the plan would be to try and address it other than do that. But is that enough? Oh, go ahead, Emma.
It is worth noting that they would argue that they are taking an active role because they have passed rules regulating volatile organic compounds,
okay,
which is a classification of chemicals that does contribute to the formation of ozone. They passed those rules to deal with the particulate pollution situation because it contributes to our particulate as well. But they feel that those rules also address ozone and would see that as taking some action.
Okay. All right. So it's not an entirely sort of passive role there, Paul Raleigh. But any comment on our ozone pollution in general? We don't like it.
Well, I have to be honest. I'm just learning about the details of ozone and the difference between that and other particulates by reading Emma's stories.
Right.
Because I didn't really have that understanding before, at least in terms of that kind of detail. But and it seems like the state recently has been I'm better educated when it comes to the issue of the particulates and the struggles over that. And for a long time, it seemed to be that the state was slow to address that pollution. We have geological issues in around Salt Lake County and up in Logan and stuff that makes that issue more difficult because we basically live in a bowl,
sure,
you know, so the particulates get trapped here in the winter and that sort of thing. It seems that the state has recently been a little more open to trying to address, you know, with some legislation and stuff. But it's always going to be hard politically in this state to aggressively go after, you know, like the oil and gas industry and that sort of thing, because they are so that industry is so wedded to the political leaders in the state. So it's always going to be a struggle. But it seems that the state, at least recently, and maybe they're just forced to do it because this issue is becoming such a health problem. But that they are kind of reluctantly or slowly, finally trying to address the issue.
Emma, we were talking about Attorney General Sean Reyes earlier and sort of pressure that he was getting from this Republican Attorney General's Association or being, I guess, sort of involved with them. The state of Utah joined Arizona, Oklahoma, and other states in opposing an ozone rule that came into effect or that was going into effect in 2015. This was something actually that Sean Reyes didn't like, the fact that he was kind of being rushed to take a stance on, though the state in the end did end up opposing this rule. Does that play into this, the fact that we are opposing or have been trying to oppose ozone rules at all? I don't know, Emma.
Well, that was something the EPA had wanted to do when, you know, Pruitt kind of took the helm. They had indicated in some communications that they wanted to consider rolling back the 2015 rule. Understand with the process here, legally, that's a little difficult. This reduction in the standard, the 2015 ozone rule, didn't just come out of nowhere. The Federal Clean Air Act requires reviews of certain pollutants that are, you know, especially identified for regulation, and they're to review the scientific literature, the EPA is, on, you know, certain intervals to determine whether or not the standards that they have set are adequately protective of human health. And if they're not, they are required by law to, you know, set a new standard that is reflective of that science. And that was what had happened here with this ozone. I don't know, you know, what happened in Scott
right.
Pruitt's mind, what happened behind closed doors. But I do know there were communications that they had indicated that they wanted to roll back this 2015 rule, that they felt like it was too low, and that ultimately it appears they've dropped that kind of rhetoric.
Okay. So right now, again, we're in this three-year period where we're waiting to see what happens with our ozone levels, and then we may trigger additional action after that three-year period. Mm-hmm. What if we just sort of skirt right along the edge of that? We can still have another 3 years after that and another 3 years after
well,
that?
Well, that's how it works. Okay. So, you know, if we don't make this deadline, if 3 years from now we're still above the standard, well, it'll be exactly like what we've seen with the particulate situation that we're familiar with, same kind of process. We'll miss the deadline, we're still over the standard, and the EPA will come in and say, okay, Utah, you had 3 years to take care of this by yourself, and now you haven't taken care of it. And so now we're going to come in and we're going to require, and the first step would be we're going to require you to write a state implementation plan, a plan for addressing the pollutant. And the EPA will review that plan and decide whether they think it's going to work and determine whether it's acceptable or not. Mm. We don't have to do that right now, but if we don't make the three-year deadline, Utah will have to do that. We have to do that right now with the particulate pollution. This is actually the second time we've done this with particulate pollution, right, because the first plan didn't work. So now we have to write another plan and submit that to the EPA with all of this evidence that it's going to work, and the EPA will review it and decide whether they think it's acceptable or not. And if the EPA says it's not acceptable, the EPA can come in and say, no, Utah, you're going to regulate X, Y, and Z because we said so.
Well, and that hasn't happened. As I listen to the process that you're describing, and it sounds almost, I mean, it sounds, what's the word I'm looking for? Extremely bureaucratic.
It is.
It seems like it could, not exponentially, but for quite a while, delay action that might need, you know, that could benefit people in the immediate term. I don't know if there's much to say about that, but.
There is certainly, that argument has certainly been made that this feels like a do-nothing approach, but the intent of the law is to gradually ratchet things down and gradually require increasing degrees of action without, you know, initially forcing the state to do things it doesn't want to do. The general principle is that with each deadline missed, Utah has less freedom to address this issue in the way that it wants. We are to the point with the particulate pollution that if we do not meet the next upcoming deadline, what will happen is they'll go to what's called the most stringent measures. And that's a legal situation where Utah would be required to adopt every rule ever used to, you know, regulate that pollutant. And there's not really anyone that I'm aware of who thinks that's a good thing.
Okay. That is Salt Lake Tribune environment reporter Emma Penrod, and we will keep following your reporting on this. We need to take another quick break here, but when we come back, we'll turn to our underplayed stories of the week and to the story of a Utah police officer who, after decades of trauma, finally got the mental health help that he needed. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
This week in This American Life, culture war.
All of you are now messengers. All of you are the people who are going to go back to your campuses and convert 10 other people.
Conservatives have targeted one of the biggest liberal strongholds, college campuses. Students are training.
We all know this. How do we film our videos, guys?
Horizontal.
Heck yeah. If you film your videos vertically.
We meet a student who follows the instructions, creates a viral video, and makes our campus explode.
Join us tomorrow morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, it's Luke Burbank. This week on LiveWire, former SNL cast member Brooks Whelan on the demystifying powers of the current U.S. president.
Before Trump, could you imagine getting to be president? No. And now you're like, he can do it? You know, like, that's how I felt once I got on Saturday Night Live. It was like, if I can do it, it's not that hard.
That's this week on LiveWire from PRI.
Join us tomorrow night at 5 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, and Paul Raleigh. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and because we need to save time for a segment on a six-part reporting series the Tribune did called Officer in Distress, we're going to have to move already to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Emma Penrod, do you want to get us started?
Sure. I read a story this week about an all-women tattoo parlor where they were, you know, providing tattoos for women who had scars from trauma, from self-harm, from breast cancer. And all of the artists there were also women. It was photography was really great. Writing was really great. It was really a very moving read.
Absolutely. Paul Raleigh, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, We once again had a story today about Mia Love attacking Ben McAdams for being a Democrat, and if the Democrats win the House, we're going to have a bunch of Democrats. And so, and the way I see that is underplayed is this is we're going to see this now on a routine basis. It's obvious to me that the Ben McAdams candidacy has the Mia Love camp running scared, and Republicans, and this is going to turn out. I mean, what is the Republican convention? She's calling Ben McAdams a baby killer and all this stuff. This is going to turn out to be one of the nastiest, dirtiest campaigns we've seen in a long time.
And it has been historically an expensive district to run in. Dan Harry, quickly, your pick for underplay.
I'm going to do the groups out there trying to get people to take their names off of initiative petitions they've signed. And a very interesting coalition formed against the legalization of medical marijuana, which includes the Utah Medical Association and the Utah Eagle Forum.
Wow. Wow.
Strange bedfellows.
Exactly. I'm going to forego my pick just because we're out of time. But Dan Harry, Emma Penrod, and Paul Raleigh, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to wrap up today with a conversation about a series the Tribune recently published that takes an in-depth look at the mental well-being of Utah police and into so much more. It's a piece of investigative reporting that spans many years by Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham. Matt, you are the author of a 6-part series the Salt Lake Tribune is publishing called Officer in Distress, and it is a sweeping, in-depth look at the survivor guilt and the trauma experienced by one Utah police officer over the course of a couple of decades on the job. And the police officer, Detective Brent Jex, is the focal point for this series. And I want to get to his story, but first I want to talk to you about the genesis of this series, because it's not just about this trauma. It's also a story about guns and about teenage criminals and gangs and a good deal more. But just what was your starting point here, Matt? How did you stumble upon this or decide to write this series?
So I first started writing about this as a young reporter, as a police reporter right out of college. And I did a story called Diary of a Gun that tracked a stolen gun from a distributor in Uinta County and how gang members passed it around until it ended in the hands of a teenager who, desperate and chased by his father, ends up turning it and killing a cop. And I wrote this at the time, and I met Detective Jex at the time. This is 2004, about when I started talking to him.
14 years ago.
And this story always stuck with me. I went on to cover politics. I went to D.C. as a Washington correspondent. I moved back in 2014 and thought, why don't I see if Detective Jex is still around, still working, and if he'd be interested in talking to me more about how stolen guns work their way through our society. So we went and had lunch. He agreed. We had a series of interviews. And probably on our third interview, I asked some question about how this has affected him over the years. And he told me that he was currently undergoing therapy. And I asked him if he'd be willing to talk about it, fully thinking the answer would be no. Right. I am not going to talk to a newspaper reporter about my therapy. And he paused and he said, yeah, sure. And as we kept talking, he let me in more and more and more.
I mean, this is the main force of the story, is how an officer deals with the trauma that he or she experiences, in this case, Detective Jex saw his life kind of falling apart, or at least he felt like he was seeing his life falling apart because of how poorly he was dealing with this, or how little he had been dealing with this. And the thing that he was dealing with, actually, we should mention, is his own sort of sense of responsibility for the death of the officer in question, the one that you mentioned from this shooting that this teenager did back in 2002. I guess maybe you should set that stage and then talk about why he felt responsible and then how he came to realize that he needed to deal with it. There's a lot packed in there, Matt, but go ahead.
Well, what I like about this story is that sometimes it would be easy. If this was a detective who was in a firefight or in a mass shooting and he has PTSD, that's obvious. We can all see that.
Right.
Detective Jex was a few hundred miles away from where that teenager shot Officer Ron Wood. And yet he blamed himself for it, because 3 days earlier, he had that teenager Justin Van Roeckel in handcuffs at the school because that teenager had made some very scary comments to his teacher about how he felt suicidal and homicidal, that he thought he might shoot a cop or shoot up the school, that he was involved in all this horrendous crimes, most of which was just wildly exaggerated. And so Jex had him in handcuffs as he tried to flee the school, and he convinced him to come back in and talk to his dad to get some counseling. And the detective thought that this teenager was okay, let him out of handcuffs. He ran. The next time Cobb found him, he shot Officer Ron Wood. So Jex felt that guilt. Now, the thing that I found so interesting about this series is that there's the obvious traumas, but there's the thing is that it can pile up. Mm-hmm. So this started in 2002, and Jex blamed himself. But then you add other things he saw throughout his career on top of it, and it just started weighing him down, where he couldn't sleep, and he was just wildly irritable. And the way he described it is that it changed his personality. It changed how he responded to his family and his friends and his job. And he didn't know how to cope.
Well, we're talking about it as though this was just the story of Officer Jex.
Yeah.
But of course, you mentioned in the article there's a statistic about how much trauma a police officer sees through the years. And how, you know, we typically think of things like PTSD, trauma, being a soldier's disease.
Yeah.
But police officers, it turns out, see a lot of difficult things to witness through their career.
And it's not just police. And, you know, if you ask Detective Jex, it's firefighters, it's paramedics, it's prosecutors and defense attorneys, it's judges. It can be jurors in a really bad case. When you see the worst of humanity in any sort of regular interval, how would it not affect you? Think about it from the highway patrolman who's monitoring Interstate 15. You see a bad car accident, do you want to drive up to that scene? And then what if you did that? What if it was your job to go to those scenes for 20 years? Are you saying it would not affect you mentally? Of course it would. And that's something that I find so interesting is I never thought about it. I knew that if you go to combat and you're in a firefight, it might affect you for the rest of your life because we've all heard the stories about the military. But when Jex talked to me about what it was like to be a police officer day in and day out, it immediately felt obvious that we all should have thought about this, and we just hadn't. And, you know, he estimates that police officers will see really gruesome or traumatic things 7 to 8 times a year. And if you do that over a 20, 25-year career, how do you get those things out of your head? You know, I just think that's really interesting.
And sort of compounding the problem is a stigma that I think is society-wide having to do with a sort of reticence to seek help when you need help. And that is probably even more so, or the stereotype at least, is that police are much less likely to seek help themselves because it's seen as a sign of weakness.
There's a couple of things. One, they're supposed to provide help. They don't get help. They're the police officer.
Right.
They're the responders. And so it's clearly a sign of weakness in their eyes. And that's obviously something that Jex thinks is wrong and needs to be changed.
Right.
But there's also a practical sense of these people carry firearms and rush into dangerous moments and have to make split-second decisions that could lead to life or death. You want them to be in optimal shape. And if a police chief believes that an officer is not mentally ready to be out on patrol, it's that police chief's responsibility to pull that person off the street. So if you're an officer on the street and you're feeling concerned, you're worried you might lose your job or at least be sidelined.
So the incentive is to hide it.
The incentive might be to hide it. And that's what Jex felt. Jex felt like, I don't want to be shamed by being a gang detective who's very good at his job to being put on desk duty. Everyone's going to wonder why. Why is he sidelined? Can he not hack it anymore? And so
the catch-22 here, though, of course, is that if you need the help, and probably most people do, then you know the police chief who might pull you because you're concerned about your mental health is doing a disservice to the community by not pulling you because you're not asking about your – I mean, it's a vicious cycle.
So what happens is you have to have a department talk about it. You have to have a culture where it's not punitive but supportive. And we have seen some steps in that area. In the last legislative session, Representative Lee Perry pushed through legislation that allowed police officers to have confidentiality when they talk to fellow police officers, peer support officers, about the trauma they experience on the job. That is a department-wide supportive way to handle it. Some police chiefs are much more supportive than some of the other ones. So essentially what we need is a culture change among law enforcement to recognize that mental health is an issue and then to treat those officers in a way that makes them feel that it's in their best interest to come forward and that it won't jeopardize their career if they say, I just need to talk to a counselor.
Detective Jex is also working on sort of removing the stigma. Part of the reason that he came and talked to you and said, yes, you can use my name and you right. can do all of this is because he wants to eliminate the fear that other officers might have of going and getting help. In fact, he wants to encourage people to get help, partially because he's also, in addition to being a detective, he's a Fraternal Order of Police president.
Right. You know, his job with the Fraternal Order of Police is to take care of his profession. And he sees this problem and he has lived through this problem and realizes that he can show people it's okay to speak up. What he did is just incredibly brave. He didn't just tell me he went to therapy. He let me talk to his therapist right. and see the therapist's notes about his sessions. He talked to me about private conversations with his wife, the most vulnerable moments he's ever had, and let me share that with people. This story is incredibly personal, and as you said, it sweeps through all kinds of different.
We haven't even touched on the fact that you're following how a gun gets from. I mean, we have a little bit from point A to point B, but how that process is followed and the ATF officers involved with that.
All the lives affected by these things, you know, just the dominoes that go through a society. You know, Jex is the entry point, but it's much broader than that. And I hope people give it a chance. It's a long story, but it should be pretty compelling.
The series is called Officer in Distress. And I understand, Matt, that the Tribune is continuing the conversation with a public forum that's going to happen as well here at the Salt Lake City Public Library.
Yes, this is on May 24th at 7. That's a Thursday. We'll have Representative Lee Perry, who I previously mentioned. We'll have Sergeant Lisa Pascalo from Salt Lake City Police. She is a peer support coordinator. We're going to have Shantae Johnson, who is the widow of Sergeant Derek Johnson, who died in the line of duty, talk about it from the family perspective. And then we're going to have Captain Mike Stevens from the fire department, who himself was once suicidal because of the things he saw on the job, who got similar therapy that Detective Jex received. And we'll talk about it from the firefighter perspective.
Wow. Matt Canham, it's a moving and really fascinating series. It's called Officer in Distress. Matt Canham is the senior managing editor for the Salt Lake Tribune and the author of this series. Check it out at sltrib.com. Thank you so much for coming in, Matt.
Thank you.
And again, that was Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks are due to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, including Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. And many thanks, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can search for Behind the Headlines in your podcast app to find podcasts of this or any of KCPW's local shows. I'm Roger McDonough. Thank you once more for tuning in. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Apogee Instruments, a Cache Valley company building precision sensors that support global research in sustainable food production, renewable energy, and climate change.
This week, we found out that Donald Trump's doctor did not write that famous statement saying that Trump would be, quote, the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. Well, who did write it? Well, here's a hint. He is not the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll ask who now praises famous men. Plus, we talk to Britt Daniels of the band Spoon on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us tomorrow morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, KUSU, FM, Logan. Also heard at upr.org.